family dinner, and I went to bed feeling warmth and love and optimism. I woke to the sound of breaking glass. My father was chasing my mother around the house, throwing beer bottles at her, yelling at her about how she was a goddamn cocktease. It seemed, and this is my adult interpretation of the memory coming in, my mother didn't want to have sex with him because she was on her period. And this had sent my father into a rage. I came out of my room in my little bare feet, ready to protect my mother. How? I don't know. What I got for my bravery was a nasty gash on my heel that required 11 stitches to close up. But that, in retrospect, wasn't nearly as bad as the 4 months of foster care that followed when my social worker discovered what happened. Those were the parents I knew, the childhood I experienced. And sure, they said they were reborn, clean and right with Jesus and all that. But how many times had I heard variations of that? They ran out of second chances with me several decades ago. There was no way I could trust the people who couldn't be bothered to give me a real childhood to have any role in Alex's upbringing. In the morning, I called Mr. Honeywell to tell him I wanted to oppose my parents' petition to be given custody of Alex. He listened without much comment. At the end, I asked, "Do you think my opinion will even matter?"
"Well, grandparents don't have any specific rights over anyone else in this process," he said. "The judge will listen to whatever we have to say. It'll probably depend on how well your boy is doing in his current placement. He's going to do what he thinks is best for your son."
"Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate..."
"Hang on, hang on. Don't run off just yet. I've got some news."
"What's that?"
"Well, a few things, actually. We've scheduled your adjudicatory hearing with Social Services for April the 10th. That's the day after your criminal case, of course. But maybe we'll have something positive to share with Judge Stone at that point."
"Let's hope so. What else?"
"I showed that picture you emailed me of that fellow with the scar to a Stanton City detective I'm friendly with."
"Oh, great," I said. That was fast.
"The detective knew him immediately. Does the name Richard Codery mean anything to you?"
It didn't. Whether he was the mystery plumber, Slash, or Richard Codery, I had never met the man before. "No. Sorry."
"Can't say I'm surprised. My detective friend had some more colorful terms for this, but Mr. Codery is what you might call a known commodity to the local police. They've picked him up for vagrancy, public intoxication, public urination, you name it."
"Oh, lovely," I said.
"Well, it might be. The detective says he's got a rap sheet that practically goes back to kindergarten. Most of it is drug-related, but there's also a breaking and entering and a malicious wounding. He's on probation right now. He's got 5 years hanging over his head for this, that, and the other thing. We can use that at the motion hearing. Plus, there are the visuals of the thing."
"What do you mean, the visuals?" I asked. He didn't immediately answer. Then he came up with,
"Well, first I should tell you I think it's wise for us to ask for a bench trial. That's where we waive the right to a jury and let the judge decide your innocence or guilt. There's been so much publicity surrounding your case, I just worry the jury pool is a little too poisoned. Besides, this judge..."
I waited for more, but it didn't come. I finally said, What about him?
Miss Barrick, I have to be careful not to sound like a dirty old man here. But you know how I asked you to wear a dress the other day?
Yes.
It's because in a court of law, appearance matters. That's why I'm going to keep asking you to wear a dress. You're a fine-looking young woman, Miss Barrick, and that will make an impression on this particular judge. I want him to have to consider you sitting there in your nice dress versus this coterie fella with his tattoos and his big scar. If we have coterie saying one thing and you saying another, and we can force the judge to decide which one of you is more likely to be telling the truth, it's possible we win. Do you follow me?
I do, I said. I was already thinking of coterie slash whatever on the witness stand, sniffling and twitching.
That's good. Okay, then. We'll talk soon.
Wait, Mr. Honeywell?
Yes, Miss Barrick?
Would it be okay if I asked an impertinent question?
You can ask me anything, Miss Barrick.
If appearance is so important, why do you dress the way you do? He just chuckled softly.
Have a good day, Miss Barrick, he said.
Chapter 39 Amy Kay couldn't remember the last time she had looked forward to Saturday morning this much. The end of her week had been like medieval torture, only the headsman was wearing wingtips. She had to insist on a formal inquiry into the missing Mookie Myers drugs, to be conducted by the state police, with oversight from the Attorney General's office. She ordered it knowing it was both fundamentally necessary and a complete waste of everyone's time. Kemp had already done an informal inquiry weeks earlier, when he first realized the drugs were gone. Augusta County's best investigator had talked to everyone with a reason to go near the evidence lockup and scoured the security camera footage. His questioning had come up empty. So had the camera, whose hard drive only had room for 30 days' worth of data. Then he told Sheriff Powers, who tore through the department, pressuring his guys to turn in any fellow deputy they suspected might be responsible. Powers assumed whoever took the drugs was using them recreationally, and he was going to make sure that deputy would find his number had randomly come up for drug testing. But even the sheriff's aggressions accomplished nothing. So, in addition to the state police, Amy had also called for a thorough review of policies and procedures related to the evidence lockup. This was the quintessential closing of the barn door after the horses were already gone. It had to be done all the same. Still, it was a grind. And now that Saturday morning was here, she was ready to put it all behind her. The weatherman said the late winter day would feel like mid-spring, with sunshine, a light breeze, and temperatures in the 70s. A perfect day for a hike. Amy's plan for herself and Butch involved a battered old map entitled Trails of Augusta County she had found for $5 in one of Stanton's myriad antique stores. It had been produced by the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1936. The young men who had carved those trails and made that map, young men who had been put to work by FDR in the depths of the Great Depression, were now very old men or gone altogether. But had their work outlived them? Were the trails still in use? Finding out would be Amy's adventure. After fortifying herself with a breakfast of waffles drenched in real maple syrup, she went into her office and spread out the map in front of her. She was ready to pick out the trail she and Butch would try first. And then the words, Mount Solon, caught her eye. Mount Solon was where Lily Pritchett had been attacked. Then she saw Weir's Cave. That was where one of the first victims she learned about had lived. Desper Hollow Road. That made her think of Melanie Barrick. Before she knew what she was even trying to accomplish, Amy found a box of pins. She hung the map on the corkboard near her desk, then placed pins in the places where she could remember assaults had taken place. There were a few where she wasn't sure of the exact address, so she looked them up in the dog-eared case files she kept in her home office. Once she was into the files, she decided she might as well do it systematically and correctly. She started over again, removing pins and putting them in a more precise place when she decided her memory of an address had faltered. She went through each file, making educated guesses at the location when it was on a modern road that did not yet exist when the map had been made. Fishersville, pin. Stewart's Draft, pin. Middlebrook, pin. She used blue pins, green pins, yellow pins, whatever she pulled out of the box. She wasn't trying to make art here. And it's not like she'd ever put something like this, an 80-odd-year-old trail map that didn't even have, say, Interstate 81 on it, in front of a jury. But it felt like a good way to informally reboot her investigation. When she was done, she walked across the room and looked at the map from that vantage point. There was no discernible pattern. Spotswood in the south, Mount Sydney in the north, Buffalo Gap out west, Sharando in the east. All points on the compass were represented. But that wasn't what really caught Amy's eye now that she was looking at the geography for the first time. It was the big, heart-shaped hole in the middle, representing the city of Stanton. There were pins on the outskirts of it, like the one just north of city limits that signified Daphne Hasper's attack. There just wasn't a single pin inside it. Stanton wasn't Amy's jurisdiction, of course. Only Augusta County was. Stanton had its own police force, its own Commonwealth's attorney. But seeing the distribution of the attacks, Amy was struck by how strange it was the rapist had never, to the best of her knowledge, struck within city limits. It was surely a target-rich environment, apartment buildings, old houses that would be easy to break into, even a women's college. She had never reached out to any of her colleagues in Stanton to learn if they were also investigating a serial rapist. Dansby wouldn't allow it. Were there other cases she wasn't aware of? Perhaps with other evidence she could now use? Or had the rapist really never found anyone to his liking inside city limits? Amy had been so focused on where this menace had attacked, she had never thought to learn from where he hadn't. Amy looked down at Butch, napping on the floor. Then she looked out the window. It was as warm and sunny as the forecast had promised. But she already knew she wasn't going on any hike. She pulled out her phone and dialed the cell phone number for Stanton City Police Chief Jim Williams. Amy had always liked the man, who paired an easygoing manner with a quick sense of humor. He also readily admitted his mistakes, and taught his officers that apologizing for small transgressions often prevented them from becoming big ones. Few things were more endearing on a police chief than humility. Once they had dispensed with a small amount of banter, Williams asked, "Anyhow, what can I do for Augusta County today?" Mindful of Dansby's standing order not to divulge her investigation, she kept it vague. "I'm doing some research into a defendant," she said, which was not untrue. "I was hoping I could get into your file room."
"Wait, I'm not the defendant, am I?"
he joked. "Not yet," she teased back.
"Okay," he said. "Meet me at the station in 15 minutes.
15 minutes later, she was in. 15 minutes after that, she was situated at a small desk in their archive room. As the day grew old, she plowed through every unsolved sexual assault file she could find, going as quickly as possible. Stanton had roughly one-third the population of Augusta County, so there were fewer cases. Most of them were easy to rule out. The attacker was the wrong size, shape, or color. In only a few files did she have to delve deeper into the police report to learn a detail that disqualified the case as being a possibility. Still, it was nearing midnight before she emerged. In all that time, she didn't find a single instance of a rapist who whispered. Chapter 40. My parents made 3 more attempts to contact me, leaving notes on my doorstep on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The first note was asking me to reconsider supporting their petition to take custody of Alex. The second suggested maybe we could share a meal, just to talk. It also offered money for a lawyer. The third said they were praying for me and hoped they might hear from me soon. They weren't going to. My anger at their sudden reappearance had abated somewhat over the weekend, but that didn't mean I was ready to resume a relationship with them. By Monday, they had perhaps gotten the hint I needed some time, because there was no note that day. Nor was there one on Tuesday. My life had slowly settled into this odd new routine. I had been slotted into the 11-7 shift at Waffle House, plus whatever stray shifts I could tack on, hoping that if I could please enough customers and get enough tips, I might be able to keep my house. I would then come home bone-weary, ankles pulsing, smelling like grease and burned coffee. I would settle into the nursing chair with Mr. Snuggs, the teddy bear, on my lap, and let thoughts of Alex fill my head while I pumped. Marcus came over a few times. Ever since Ben left, he had been checking in on me daily. We ordered takeout, that he paid for, watched movies, played board games, whatever. Kelly was working late, seemingly all the time. It felt like forever since I had seen her. So we both needed the company. I also hung out with Teddy some. He and Wendy were supposedly trying to take it slow with their rekindling, making a conscious effort not to spend all their time together. I was happy to help with that. Then there were nights when I just didn't feel like I was fit to be around people. I stayed home by myself and tried to make my mind as empty as possible. That way, I didn't have to think about the missing baby and absent husband who until recently had filled my life. I would lose myself in brain-rotting television and attempt to drift off to sleep in front of whatever cooking show, HGTV special, or Castle rerun my restless remote control had settled on. It didn't always work. The misery simply overwhelmed me, and I couldn't even see the images on the screen. I'd find myself crying uncontrollably or screaming into a pillow, unable to fend off the tsunami of sadness that threatened to wash me away. At times like that, I was confronting the very real possibility of being convicted of a crime I didn't commit. It was an offense that came with essentially 2 punishments. One was serving 5 years in prison. The other, the far harsher of the two, was losing my child. And the term was life. I could already imagine myself, newly released, harder and sadder, slinking from one playground and elementary school to the next, looking for a baby I might not even recognize as a 5- or 6-year-old. And then, more of the same. Forever. I already knew the ache would never go away. Some part of me would always be yearning for him. With Ben, the pain would eventually fade, but that made it no less poignant in the present. It was a mix of missing him, his touch, his companionship, the way he always made things seem better, and being truly angry with him. Just because I had given him permission to leave, it didn't mean he was supposed to take me up on the offer.
Twice, I actually did hear from him. Sort of. One time, he called. I nearly answered, then decided I really didn't want to talk to him. When I listened to the message, it was this nonsensical rambling, delivered at a volume that was barely audible. I just wanted to hear your voice. I'm so lonely right now. I hope you get this someday, and because if you do, it means it's a happier time. But I can't think about that too much right now. It'll make me... Anyhow, I miss you. I miss you so much. I love you. And I guess I just wanted you to know that. This prompted me to swear at the phone, then at Ben. I finished my little tirade with, "If you miss me so much, why'd you leave, you dumbass?" His other attempt to contact me was via text, which I got when I came out of Waffle House one day. "Hey, I know I won't hear back from you. I just want you to know I'm thinking about you. I'm missing you so much right now. Love you." It made me feel like I was in college, dating a frat boy who tried to break up, then worm his way back into my bed a week later with insistences that he really loved me all along. I didn't fall for it back then, and I sure wasn't going to now, despite one or two weak moments when I nearly gave in to the temptation to call him. Otherwise, I just hobbled along, all the while keeping track of my various legal entanglements. Mr. Honeywell was still trying to pry the name of the confidential informant in my drug case out of the sheriff's office in time for the motion hearing. The negotiations were contentious. The sheriff's office was balking at revealing the identity of its informant, who was, after all, supposed to be confidential. The judge promised he would close the courtroom and seal the transcripts, which satisfied the sheriff's office. But it didn't satisfy the Commonwealth's attorney's office, which brought up concerns about witness retaliation in drug cases. The prosecutor, Amy Kay, didn't want to reveal the informant's name until the hearing itself. But Mr. Honeywell won that issue, too. There was apparently a case involving a man named Keener a bunch of years back, where an appeals court had ruled the Commonwealth had to both reveal the name of its witness and do so in a reasonable time period to allow the defense time to prepare. This was all being haggled over on Tuesday, while I was dishing out hash browns, scattered, smothered, and covered, at Waffle House. So I wasn't privy to the details. I just know that by the time my shift ended, I had an urgent voicemail from Mr. Honeywell. The judge had finally come up with a plan that satisfied all sides. And it involved a face-to-face meeting with the defendant. First thing Wednesday morning, I met Mr. Honeywell in the lobby of the courthouse. He had asked me to wear something nice, so I picked out a light blue sleeveless knit dress that I had acquired during one of my thrift store dives. He was back to his gray suit. I was beginning to think it was the only one he owned. As soon as I was through the metal detector, he rose from a bench and limped toward me.
"Good morning, Miss Barrick. You're looking lovely today."
"Thanks," I said, shaking his hand. "What's this all about, anyway?"
"Search me," he said with a little shrug. "Judge Robbins used to be the Commonwealth's attorney in Waynesboro. We've had our battles. He's not one to do the defense any favors, believe me. And he can be a little, well, unconventional, put it that way. He said he wanted to meet with you before he revealed the identity of the confidential informant. And if you ask me, it's best to give a judge what he wants. So, here we are."
I followed Mr. Honeywell at his slow pace up to the second floor. We sat in Judge Robbins's reception area for a while, waiting for the judge to do whatever it is judges do when they're not on the bench. Then we were summoned into a room lined by bookshelves, with a stately oak desk in the middle of the room. Behind it was a white-haired white man in a dark blue suit. He had two chins. A light dusting of goatee did little to help define the first. There were three chairs in front of the judge's desk. One was filled by Amy Kay.
"Good morning, Judge," Mr. Honeywell said,
then nodded toward the prosecutor.
"Miss Kay."
"Come in,
come in,"
the judge said. He had a high-pitched, somewhat pinched voice. He struggled to get his gut out from under the desk as he stood up to greet us.
"Judge, I'd like you to meet Melanie Barrick."
"Good God, Bill, this is your client?" Judge Robbins said.
I suppose he had been expecting the Melanie Barrick he had seen in my mugshot, a woman in an orange jumpsuit with tousled hair. His gaze traveled up and down my body at least three times. I was starting to appreciate Mr. Honeywell's sartorial wisdom, to say nothing of his legal mind. Now I fully understood why he talked about the visuals when he told me he was opting for a bench trial. In my college feminist days, I might have been offended about the objectification of women, the tyranny of the patriarchy, and all those other things that had been so important back then. They still were, but not as important as my son.
"Yes, sir,"
Mr. Honeywell said evenly. "Nice to meet you, Judge," I said. Without any hint, I knew he was screwing me with his eyes. The judge attempted to recover himself.
"Have a seat, please."
Mr. Honeywell and I took the chairs on the left side, just like this was a courtroom. Kay sat in the one on the right.
"Miss Barrick, I..."
Judge Robbins began, then stopped himself. He still seemed a little rattled. Finally, he settled on,
"As you're aware, Miss Barrick, the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office has some issues with revealing to you and your attorney the identity of the confidential informant," he said,
tipping his head toward Kay.
"I assume your attorney has explained this to you?"
"Yes, sir," I said.
"I understand her concerns, of course. At the same time, you have your constitutional rights, and I can't deny them to you. Ultimately, the Commonwealth has to produce this witness so we can have what's known as a Franks hearing. But before I tell you and your attorney who this witness is, I want you and I to have an understanding about something."
"Yes, sir," I said again. He pointed a fat finger at me.
"We don't have problems with witness intimidation here in the Valley, and we're going to keep it that way. Do you understand? Killing a witness is a capital offense in Virginia. Do you know what that means?"
I glanced at Mr. Honeywell, whose eyes were even more bugged out than usual.
"It means you'd get the death penalty," the judge continued.
Mr. Honeywell gripped his chair. Even Amy Kay seemed unsettled.
"Judge," she began, "I don't think this is really..." "I'm not talking to you, Miss Kay. I'm talking to Miss Barrick here. I know there are some liberal judges up north who get squeamish about the death penalty. I'm not one of those judges. Now, you don't seem like the type to make any trouble, but I don't want to judge a book by its cover. If anything happens to this witness, I will hold you personally accountable. I don't want him threatened. I don't want him harassed. I don't want anyone you're associated with to approach him in any way. And by God, if he disappears, I will see to it you get the needle if it's the last thing I do. Are we clear?"
"Judge,"
Mr. Honeywell said, no longer able to hide his outrage.
This is highly inappropriate and incredibly prejudicial. I don't—
Shut it, Billy. I ain't talking to you either, Robin said, then returned his attention to me.
Are we clear, miss?
Yes, sir, I said, a third time. What else was there to say?
Good. Now, he said,
then started hunting for something on his desk.
Ah, yes. Here we go. This is the confidential informant. Miss Kay was good enough to print out his rap sheet for us all. He's no choir boy, of course. They never are. But this hearing will be about his actions in regards to this case. It will not be an airing of his criminal history. Got it?
Mr. Honeywell glared at him for a moment before allowing a terse,
"Yes, sir."
Judge Robbins slid a folder across the desk at Mr. Honeywell, who picked it up. He leaned toward me a little so I could see it. The first page was a mugshot, and it nearly caused me to fall out of my chair. The confidential informant was Slash, a.k.a. Richard Cotery, a.k.a. the mystery plumber. So not only had he planted the drugs in my house, he had also called the sheriff's office to tell them the drugs were there, then lied about making a buy from me. He then told the sheriff's office, and after that, social services, that I had inquired about selling my baby. This, for $5,000 and a pile of cocaine. All I could think about was the trouble I would be in if Richard Cotery died of an overdose, or if he accidentally got hit by a car, or found early death any of the other number of ways an addict can wind up killing himself, or if Teddy and Wendy decided the next act of their romantic play would be to go after the man. Mr. Honeywell made a strange noise in his throat. I didn't need to tell him this was the same man I had photographed in Hardee's. He had already figured it out, and was now trying to reconcile it with known facts, just like I was.
Thank you, Judge, is all he said.
I'm serious, Miss Barrick. You are not to have any contact with this witness. Are we clear?
Yes, Judge, I said.
All right. I'm glad we understand each other, he said, standing up. Thank you all for coming.
The three of us stood up. Amy Kay said farewell. Mr. Honeywell didn't say a word. He was still clearly furious, and he was limping toward the door before he uttered something he'd later regret. I followed him out. Once we were back in the judge's waiting room, I thought that was the end of things. But Amy Kay surprised me by calling out, "Miss Barrick, do you have a moment?" I turned to face her. She was older than me by about a decade, solidly built, with a no-nonsense cut to her short, dark hair. The first time we had met, a year before, we had been on the same side of the law. Now, we were adversaries. Curiously, there was something about her demeanor toward me that hadn't changed. I couldn't say exactly what. I just knew she still passed the 5-second test. "Yes," I said. Mr. Honeywell had stopped and turned. "I haven't forgotten what happened to you last March," she said. "Oh," was all I could think to say in reply. "March 8th," she said, looking me straight in the eyes, holding her gaze there so I'd know she was serious. Then she reiterated, "I haven't forgotten." "Thank you," I said. She nodded, then exited. Chapter 41. The comment had surprised Amy probably even more than it had Melanie Barrick. "I haven't forgotten what happened to you." Amy hadn't gone into Judge Robbins's chambers for that meeting thinking she'd say a thing. Melanie Barrick was the defendant in a major drug case. Yes, it sometimes happened that perpetrators of one crime had been victims of another. But Amy was usually quite clear about separating the two. Really? Where had those words come from? Was it just because she felt bad for this woman after Robbins, loose cannon and noted law and order lunatic, had threatened her? Or was it guilt about having struck out with Warren Plotz? Or was it because she had spent so much time after work staring at that pinned-up map in her home office? She still hadn't decided what to make of that. Maybe nothing. It was entirely possible the rapist was simply being cautious. Stanton was a city. Not a big city, but a city nevertheless. It was more densely populated than the county, and that meant more neighbors to see things, more cops per square mile, more chances to be caught. There were very practical reasons to steer clear of it. Or did the fact that the man had seemingly focused so narrowly on Augusta County really mean something? The human brain is hardwired with a fervent desire to make sense of the world, to create connections between events whether they exist or not. From a rationalist's standpoint, it's something of a design flaw. It's what led ancient people to believe if they danced a certain way, the rain would fall. It's what led modern people to believe vaccines caused autism. Amy was trying to guard against that kind of thinking now, especially when there were two recent developments her brain was craving to link up. The first was the missing drugs, which had been taken from a supposedly secure lockup in the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. Second was her map, with all its pins, every last one of them within the jurisdiction of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. It was leading her to a conclusion she absolutely did not want to draw. She thought of Skip Kemp, of Jason Powers. Physically, both fit the incredibly broad description of an average-size white male under the age of 50. But she knew these men, didn't she? They were decent to the core, dedicated lawmen. She remembered Powers's voice when he told her about Lily Pritchett, and his excitement when he found the prints at the scene. She considered Kemp, the Aldous Huxley reader, and the way he patiently testified at trials. No way were those two responsible. It had to be someone else from their office. But now, as she walked back to her office from the judge's chambers, there was one more event she found herself attempting to lasso in with the others. The Melanie Barrick drug bust. Truly, Barrick was an outlier in the drug world, an educated, married mother with no record, suddenly turning to dealing at age 31. Amy had dismissed any thought of how unlikely that was, simply because there was no question the drugs had been discovered in the woman's house. Except, who made the discovery? Deputies from the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, with Kemp as lead investigator, and Powers as the boss of it all. Ridiculous. Totally. Correlation is not causation. Dances don't make the rain fall. There were probably attacks in Stanton and in nearby counties she simply didn't know about. She just had to keep plugging away until she got some kind of break. Check that. She had gotten a break. She had the fingerprint now. She'd send that off to the lab in Roanoke and wait patiently for any results. If she kept following the process, like she hadn't done with plots, she'd eventually get this guy. As for Melanie Barrick, yes, she remained an unlikely drug dealer. But Amy had to chase all the conspiracy theories from her mind. It was her job as a prosecutor to present enough evidence to overcome reasonable doubt, not to definitively disprove every possibility that a wildly inventive mind could create. And there was no question what a reasonable person would conclude, given the facts of the case. Amy arrived back at her office to find a note on her desk from Aaron Dansby, requesting an audience. She had already ignored one such note on Tuesday afternoon, so she decided to get it over with. She made the short stroll down the hallway and into the pages of Southern Living. Dansby was wearing one of his good suits and a bow tie. Claire had struck again.
"Hey," he said when he saw her in the doorway. "Grab a chair. I just wanted an update. What's new with my man Mookie's appeal? Powers find those drugs yet?"
"Nope, sorry," Amy said, taking a seat. "And we might as well start facing the fact that they probably never will." Dansby drummed a pen on his desk.
"So break this down for me. When is this all going to come out?"
"After mid-April, if that's what you're worried about," Amy said. "I haven't even filed our response yet. I've got a few weeks to do that. Then the appellate court will schedule oral arguments. That won't happen for a few months. Then they'll issue a ruling, which will take another little while. Then if the ruling goes against us, it gets tossed back to circuit court, at which point the trial gets scheduled. I'm sure we're looking at after November."
"Really?"
he said, brightening more.
"You think you could delay it that long?"
"It's not me delaying it. That's just how long it takes."
"Well, that's great news," he said.
Amy might have been angry, except she was so unsurprised. Dansby didn't care about losing the conviction as long as he had already won the election.
"Anyhow," he continued, "I'm speaking to Rotary in a few minutes, and I want to give them something good. What's up with Kokomo?"
Amy didn't need to be told there was a large overlap between Rotary and the crowd that would determine Dansby's political future. "We've got a motion hearing a week from Friday," she said.
"A motion hearing? What motion?"
"The defense is challenging the warrant. They're trying to say the CI the sheriff's office used made everything up."
"What?"
Dansby said, sitting up, alarmed.
"Did he?"
"I doubt it. Kemp said the guy is solid." Dansby nodded, but Amy could tell from his face he was still working something out.
"So the motion hearing consists of Kemp testifying?"
he asked.
"Him and the CI, yeah."
"The CI testifies?"
"Yeah." "So the confidential informant doesn't get to stay confidential? That doesn't seem right. Can't we fight that?"
"We already tried," Amy said. "Ultimately, if the defense makes an issue out of it, the sheriff's office eventually has to show its hand. Melanie Barrick has a right to face her accuser."
"You're going to put the CI on the stand?"
"Well, technically, the defense has to put him on the stand. For purposes of this hearing, the CI is actually their witness. So is Kemp, for that matter. It makes things a little tougher on the defense, because it means it can't just sit back and potshot like it normally does. It has to actually build an argument."
"Yeah, but what happens if the CI cracks under the pressure or gets tripped up? I mean, a good lawyer can turn anyone in circles."
"Then it's up to me to rehabilitate him on cross," Amy said.
"But if it's really bad, I mean, these CIs, they're mostly druggies and losers, right? If this guy was a real mess on the stand, what happens then?"
"Theoretically, we could lose the search warrant. And if we lost the warrant, we'd lose the case. But that's not going to happen. Not with Robbins hearing this. You should have heard him earlier today. I was in his office when he told Melanie Barrick that if anything untoward happened to the CI before he had a chance to testify, he'd personally see to it she got the needle." Amy was shaking her head. Dansby smiled.
"I always did like that guy.
Point is, he's not going to let us lose this warrant, Amy said.
All right. So I can tell Rotary everything is on track for a conviction?
Amy thought about reasonable doubt and rain dances.
Absolutely, she said. It's as good as done.
Chapter 42. Wednesday night was another torture session disguised as slumber, with my thoughts jumping from one awful subject to the next. Alex, and who had him, and what they were doing with him, and whether he was being loved and cared for, was, as usual, first and foremost. But what Judge Robbins had threatened me with was certainly in there as well. Barely sleeping Wednesday night made the swelling in my ankles worse all day Thursday. By the time I made the drive home from Waffle House that evening, it had moved up to my knees. For my pain and suffering, I had made $81.77, thanks to a tour bus full of unusually heavy tippers that came through around lunchtime. Before turning up my driveway, I checked my mailbox and, once again, did not find any note from my parents. Just a credit card bill and some junk mail. I was inside the house when I opened the bill. Then I gasped. I don't put much on the card under normal circumstances, and had been especially careful lately, given my dire financial situation. That's why I immediately knew the number was all wrong. It was at least $700 more than I expected, which was $700 I couldn't afford if I was going to succeed in scraping together a mortgage payment for April. With a spurt of panic, I delved into the statement itself. The first charge I didn't recognize was from a gas station in Pennsylvania. Then there were more charges from hotels, fast food restaurants, and gas stations in New Jersey, a state I had most certainly not been in. But obviously, Ben had been. From March 10th through 12th, my estranged husband had stayed at a hotel in Camden. On March 13th and 14th, he moved up to Elizabeth. From there, I couldn't say. March 14th was the last day of the billing cycle. Camden made sense, being that it was just across the river from Philadelphia. He might have just been looking for a cheaper place while he made arrangements to begin at Temple with Professor Kramer. But if that was true, what was he doing in Elizabeth? I pulled out my phone to check, and sure enough, it was an hour and a half drive north of the Philadelphia area. Was there another college or university in that area? There were, actually, several. Within a short drive, there was Keene University, Seton Hall, Rutgers Newark, and many others. I could have called him to find out, except I really didn't want to talk to the man. All I would have ended up doing was screaming at him. So I did the next best thing. I called the credit card company, explained the situation, and got them to shut down the account. Passive-aggressive? Sure. Satisfying? Absolutely. When I was done, I went up to the nursery. It was time to pump. Mr. Snuggs was there, waiting for me. I looked into his glassy little eyes. You would never run up a credit card bill on me, would you? I asked him. Mr. Snuggs had no response. So where am I going to get $700 freaking? Mr. Snuggs said nothing. Then my phone rang. It was Marcus.
Hey, I said.
Hey, what are you up to?
Talking to a teddy bear, wondering if I'm losing my mind.
You want me to come over? Maybe bring some tie? Kelly has to work late again, so it'd just be us.
That sounds so good, but honestly, I'm just completely wiped out. I barely slept at all last night.
I understand, he said. Is everything okay? You sound down. Did something happen today?
The bill I had tossed aside was at my feet. I looked down at it. I'm sure Marcus had $700. If I asked him for a loan, he'd say yes. He wouldn't hesitate. But I couldn't. I already owed him too much. No, just tired, I said.
Okay, he said. You know if you need anything, all you have to do is ask, right?
It was like he could read my mind. But I guess that's what best friends do. Yeah, I know. Thanks, Marcus. You're awesome.
All right, he said. Well, I guess I'll talk to you later.
Have a good night.
You too.
I looked at Mr. Snuggs one last time. He had fallen on his side, so I righted him, then gave him an affectionate pat before hooking myself to the machine and letting it go to work. Chapter 43.
Richard Cotery's money was getting low. So was his coke stash. He had abandoned all attempts at rationing himself. The only thing that slowed him down at all was a persistent nosebleed. He was now snorting as much blood as he was cocaine. The party was coming to an end. Unless he could find a way to keep it going. With that in mind, he had called the man again, saying he wanted more money. The man refused. Cotery was pissed. But what could he do? Then he got that subpoena, which had been served on him at room 307 at the Howard Johnson. How the cops even knew he was there, he didn't know. That prompted another phone call to the man. He left a message this time. And maybe there had been more of a threat involved. He hadn't quite said, "Hey, it's Slash. I've been subpoenaed. Give me more money or else I'll tell everyone what I did for you." Well, maybe he had said something like that. The man had called back, furious, saying that wasn't the deal, saying Cotery had been compensated lavishly for what he had done. The man reminded Cotery he would go to jail if everything came out. He also reminded Cotery that he didn't actually know the man's name, so what was he going to tell the authorities? That some guy had paid him to plant drugs in the woman's house? What would that accomplish? Cotery said he didn't care. He said he liked prison. That was a bluff, of course. No way Cotery was going back behind bars. But the man didn't know that. He had made all kinds of angry noises, told Cotery never to call him again, all that. Whatever. Cotery knew the guy would fold. In a game of chicken, the winner is always the person with less to lose. So Cotery smiled when he saw the number pop up on his phone. It was late Thursday night, maybe early Friday morning, and Cotery was impossibly high. His bluff had worked. He was about to be rich again. He'd make it last this time.
"Hey, it's Slash."
"I've been thinking about what you said," the man said.
"Yeah? What you been thinking?"
"I'll give you the money. But you have to do another job for me."
"Like last time?"
"Yeah, basically. Different person, of course."
"But the same pay?"
"Yeah." Cotery's smile grew wide enough that what few teeth he had remaining were now showing.
"All right," he said. "Who do you want me to do?"
"I don't want to talk about it over the phone," the man said. "You still at the Howard Johnson? Room 307?
"Yeah."
"See you there in 15 minutes. It was more like 30 by the time Cotery heard the knock on his door. He took a quick glimpse through the peephole. The man had a hat pulled low and sunglasses on, just like the last time. But this time he was also wearing a jacket with its collar pulled up. It was a jacket with a lot of pockets.
His hands were in two of the pockets, and one seemed to have a bulge in it. Coterie didn't like the look of it. He slid the chain silently off its track. Then, in one quick motion, he opened the door, grabbed the man by the front of his jacket, and threw him into the room. He hurtled across the room, stumbling, using the dresser to break his fall. The man turned, but Coterie was already on him, patting down the jacket. No way this guy was getting the drop on Slash. "Would you cut it out?" the man said as Coterie groped him. His pockets were empty. The bulge had been nothing but air. "Just making sure you're not armed," Coterie said, stepping away as the man readjusted his clothing, tugging his hat down low again. "I'm not. Jesus, how coked out are you?"
"Whatever. What's the plan? Where's my money? Where's my stuff?"
"Relax. I had to hide it," the man said. "My wife has been snooping around the house lately."
"Okay."
"We need to go for a walk," the man said.
"Where?"
"I'll show you. Come on." Coterie fell in behind the guy, who moved at a quick pace, his head down. They passed by dark houses and closed storefronts. Every time Coterie tried to ask a question, the man told him to shut up and keep walking. Eventually, they reached the iron gates at the corner of Thorn Rose Cemetery. The man continued past them, then hopped over the low stone wall just beyond. Coterie came to a stop.
"Where are you going?"
he asked. "It's just up this way."
"I ain't going in there."
"You are if you want to get paid."
"What are you talking about?"
Coterie said. "I hid everything in my family's crypt. It was the only place I knew it would be safe. I've got the key." Coterie didn't move. He knew there was nothing inherently dangerous about a cemetery, but it was still creepy. "What are you, afraid of some old tombstones?" the man goaded him. "You want the stuff or not?"
"Yeah, whatever,"
Coterie said, and fell in behind the man as they walked at an angle up the hill. "It's just over that way," the man said. They walked deeper into the cemetery. There wasn't much more than a sliver of a moon. They were now away from the glow of the streetlights. The man had removed his sunglasses. Coterie didn't like the feeling of any of this. He might have turned around, but he knew he'd like the feeling of cocaine withdrawal even less. The party had to keep going. "Here we are," the man said at last. He had stopped beneath a large limestone mausoleum with a monument out front. Coterie could make out the name Eccles etched onto it. So that was this guy's name? Eccles? The man had scaled up some steps, then bent down to pick something up. "Just getting my flashlight," he said. "This key is really finicky. You mind holding this for me?"
"Yeah, whatever."
The man turned the flashlight toward him, shining it in Coterie's face, momentarily blinding him. Coterie winced at the light, squinting and shielding his eyes. Which is why he never saw the baseball bat coming. Not even when it connected with a sickening crack on the side of his head. Coterie staggered, but did not fall. With all the cocaine in his system, it would take a lot more than a one-handed swing to stop him. He lunged at the man, still blind from the light. Coterie was aiming for eyeballs, hoping to gouge them out. He missed, landing nothing more than a superficial scratch on the man's neck. By then, the man had put down the flashlight. He was using both hands now. The next swing put Coterie down. The swing after that put him out. Chapter 44. I slept like a corpse that night. The morning was another story. When I first rolled over and saw the clock, 6:28, I told myself I should get out of bed and start being productive.
maybe do some yoga before work. Then I fell right back to sleep. During that second stint, I had a recurrence of the dream that had become the ugly weed of my subconscious. No matter how many times I